Blog Talk Radio.
She's nuts for them, so I let her deal with most of those.
When I was in college, I also went and did a internship at the Kentucky Reptile Zoo for a couple months. And so when after I graduated college, I was able to get a job here at the Oklahoma City Zoo as a
Nice.
reptile keeper. And
Very nice.
so I've been working here for years. I actually transferred last year to the children's zoo section where I deal with I came over here to do a these couple buildings. It's a brand new section here, and I got a couple buildings that are mainly invertebrates. A lot of tarantulas, scorpions, stuff like that, and just kind of gives me a little bit more freedom and kind of do whatever I want with that. So, a lot of fun.
Interesting. I didn't know you were in the zoo setting. I think you and I had something in common there.
Oh,
So, yeah, I was lead of reptiles at the Bucks County Zoo out here in Pennsylvania for a while.
oh,
So,
cool.
yeah, it's definitely very cool. Now, you said you got kind of got into the scrub complex. What led you there? What brought you to them? What did you find interesting about them that eventually got you to get involved with the scrubs?
Well, what really got me into him was my buddy Robert Weaver, who used to keep them back in the day, and he kind of got me into a lot of the stuff. And after I'd gotten a bunch of the carpets and bloods and all that, he was telling me, well, one of my favorite things I used to work with were scrub pythons. You should get some of them. And he told me they're nasty and hard to breed and poop all over you and all that stuff. And for some reason, I thought that was a great idea. I still don't know why I thought that sounded great, but I started looking into them, and what first thing that really drew me to them was their big heads with their big scales, and I've always just thought that was the coolest looking thing, and also really fell in love with the patterns and all that. So eventually, I picked up a captive hatched southern scrub, I think from Triple L Reptile or something, and got it before its first shed, and
Wow.
so it was really fresh.
Young. Yeah, it's a little risky in my opinion.
I didn't know at the time that that was its first shed. I saw they had captive hatch southerns and got it, and and I realized after it shed it within a few days of me getting it, I went, I think that was its first shed. It was still solid red, no pattern or anything, and it was pretty tiny. And but it ate, first time I offered, and just went, out from there. And and then I of course just fell in love with it and started getting more. I think the second one was a another southern from Jim Kurowski. And then eventually after I met Nick Mutton and Ryan Young, they didn't help that at all. So yeah,
No,
I
no, no. That normally doesn't
picked
help. You just
them.
kind of exacerbate the issue. Yeah. So, no. We everyone can understand that. So, all right. Now your company is called Python Central. And how did you get started with that? What brought about you like deciding, hey, why not breed this and start seeing what we can do with it?
For some reason, whenever I started keeping snakes, I always, thought, well, it'd be just really awesome to breed these things, I can keep them alive, and just kind of the next step for me was to try and breed them. I guess I always kind of like challenges, and that was just the next challenge. All right, let's breed them and sell them, and maybe,
See what happens.
yeah, see if I can maybe, at least pay for, my hobby here.
Rodent builds are expensive. Yeah, we can all.
Exactly. And
Right.
when you constantly are wanting new things and stuff, you need money to pay for that as well, and so
Exactly. Got to pay for the next one. All right.
I eventually decided, all right, I want to breed these things, make a business out of it, and kind of make a see if I can make a name for myself, get a website going and all that. And was just trying to decide on a name, and I didn't really want to go with just Blake Bauer Reptiles or something like that,
Right.
because nobody knows who the hell Blake Bauer is. So, you know, I figure something catchy, whatever, and my wife actually came up with Python Central. And it really just comes from, you know, at the time I was going to Central Washington University in Central Washington, and, you know, I mainly deal with Python, so it just seemed to fit.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah. So no real deep meaning behind it, just kind of fit.
Yeah. It's all right. It's all you need sometimes.
So, yeah, and, you know, just, you know, it's always been me and my wife, and I kind of do all the scrubs and the carpets and, you know, white lips and all of that weird stuff, and she mainly does the chondros and ball pythons, and she's also got a few other things, a few milk snakes and king snakes, stuff like that.
Jeez, white lips. Well, you must be a glutton for punishment.
I am. I think I must have some sort of, I don't know, psychological problems or something. If I, like, my favorite two snakes are scrub pythons and white lip pythons, so.
Long teeth and bad attitudes. Got it.
Exactly.
All right. So now, how many scrubs are you currently working with? Like how big is your collection, and what type of scrubs are you working with?
I think the count I had today was 18.
Wow.
So you have a trio of Aru scrubs, a pair of Moluccan scrubs, a pair of Sarong Barnecks, a trio of Waminas, a trio of Halmaheras, and 3.2 Tannum bars.
Wow.
So,
okay.
I think that's it.
That's just the scrubs. Just 18 is just the scrubs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got way more than that and other things, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a pretty extensive collection you got there. Now, can you tell us about the different species in the complex? I know, because, like I said when you and I were talking in the pre-show, I don't own any scrubs. I have had friends who've owned scrubs, and, you know, my favorite story to tell about scrubs and white lips is one of my friends opening the cage of his white lip python and then closing it, and the white lip being halfway out trying to, like, snap his jaws at my friend, who was just that far away that the white lip couldn't get at him. So, what kind of species do you have, or what are the other different species in the complex?
Well, the main one, or the one that has the most kinds or whatever, is Amethystina, which are the New Guinea scrubs.
Okay.
Then there's King Horneye, which is the Australian scrub. Clastolepis, which is the Moluccan python. Nada, which is Tannum bar python, and Tracea, which is the Halmahera python. Those are the five that are they're classified right now. There will probably be more.
Okay. Oh, so they're still working on it. All right.
Yeah.
Well, they're still working on everything, so it's okay. Now, which ones are the longest? Which is the biggest ones, and which ones would you like recommend highly?
Well, the longest ones are the Australian scrubs.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed record for those is 28 feet, but.
What?
It's a little sketchy that, you know, it's like, you know, when you hear about the 50-foot retics or whatever.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You know, it I think that was measured back in, like, the 50s or something, and it wasn't preserved or anything like that, so it's, we're not fully sure if that's it, if that is a true measurement or not. But they certainly can get, you know, 20 feet or so.
Wow.
And after that, a lot of the New Guinea scrubs can get up to 16 feet or so.
Jeez.
And then you got, you know, smaller ones like the Tannum bar pythons, which stay pretty much about green tree python size and, you know, only about 6 feet. So there's a lot of variation in them.
Okay. Now, which one would you recommend as a good starter scrub for somebody who's just getting out there in scrubs? Or is it kind of doesn't matter? The scrub is a scrub. You're, you know, going to get bit either way.
Well, there's the Barnecks and Southerns are probably good ones to start with in some ways because they are some of the easier ones to keep. They captive bred ones. can be really docile. The only problem is they can get pretty good size, you know, up to 16 feet. The Moluccans, I'd say, in some ways are good too, because they stay smaller, and a lot of them can be pretty calm as well. Problem is most are wild caught, and they can be a little bit harder than a lot of the Amethystinas.
Okay. So,
but probably I'd say, you know, Barnecks would be a good one.
Okay.
Because those have been bred most regularly lately. Southerns are easy, but nobody really breeds them right now, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. So now when people say northern and southern scrubs, what are they referring to?
They're referring to the Amethystina,
okay.
Which there's, as I was saying a minute ago, there was, you know, there's probably more species that will be described.
Right.
Amethystina is kind of a group of all the different scrubs that they haven't placed in a different section yet.
It's like a catch-all. They all go here. Okay. So that's probably going to be broken up as they start, you know, classifying better, I guess, is what you're predicting?
Exactly. So the northern scrubs are the Barnecks. And the southern scrubs are, southerns are also called Marooks, Roos, the Kay Islands, and Biaks. And then also the Amethystina. They're also including ones from the Bismarck Islands, which are east of Papua New Guinea. That those are most likely a new species, but we don't have enough data from them to be able to classify them as that, so they're put in Amethystina. And the reason that the southerns and northerns haven't been split into two different species, like we, from the genetic testing and everything we've done so far, they seem to be very different. But we don't have any data from the Papua New Guinea side of the island. So we can't say for certain that everywhere in the range they're completely different. There's no genetic flow or anything like that.
Okay.
So that's why they're both still in that same species.
I see what you're getting at.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, there could be possibly more forms that have yet to be found, as well as, you know, once somebody goes down there and decides to do the research, it's going to be broken up all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, there's...
Okay.
I was reading something. Barker's put out a paper they did, and they're saying there could be two or three or maybe more new species of scrubs out in the Bismarcks. So,
wow.
I mean, a large group of islands, and, I mean, nobody really goes there, so nobody's really able to do any research on them or bring any specimens back. And Papua New Guinea, you know, they don't really let too many people in there, and they don't allow the exportation of any of their animals, you know, just like Australia. So, you know, there could possibly be new forms over there, but most likely it's just, you know, southerns and Barnecks probably range over there, but, you know, it'd be nice to have those DNA samples to compare.
Yeah. So somebody's just got to get off their butt and head down there and get it done. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Which,
you know, there's a lot of problems with that because,
You
know, it's hard to get in the country for one thing, and there's, you know, not a lot of people working with scrub pythons and not a lot of money in it, so.
Right. There's all those things, too.
Yep.
All right, then. Now, can you give us a rundown of, you gave us a rundown of the localities. What are some of the characteristics of each locality, like colors, things like that? That we can look into it.
Okay. So, I guess let's start with the Australian scrubs, which are the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of generally tan with heavily patterned with sort of a dark, almost black patterning.
Yeah.
And the southern scrubs from Amethystina are very similar looking, but they tend to be look a little more hypo-ish. I mean, at first, when you look at the two of them, they look pretty much the same, and I know a lot of people have thought they are pretty much the same, you know. You know, a lot of people wonder if they were the same. Well, they used to be the same species. And then they actually did some work on them, and turns out the King Horni are more closely related to the Tanimbar pythons.
Okay.
Which is weird because it's the biggest one and the smallest one are actually the closest related.
And whatever. So,
so
things you figure out.
It's kind of, we're describing all these, you know, without, it's hard to describe them without, you know, having a picture to show everybody.
Looking at them, it's fine. People can, everybody Google as he talks, okay?
Just yeah.
Google everything, Google the picture, the name, and you'll understand. So, well, that's
anyways,
cool.
The Southerns, they can get, you know, up to 16 feet or so, probably, you know, 13, 14 feet is more of the usual. They can have the black bars on their neck, like the northern populations do, but not all of them do. They tend to be more faint than the bar necks do.
Okay.
Their back section is heavily patterned, the sort of last third of their tail, as is most of the southern localities. Aru's are very similar. These are Aru Islands, which are off the southwest coast of New Guinea. They're brown to gold, a little more gold than the Marooks. I think they're really pretty. They're one of my favorite localities. One of the main things that sets them apart from the Southerns is they have these kind of rosettes, which...
Really?
I guess the best way to describe them is just a small cluster of lighter colored scales. Kind of make like a little circular thing. It's hard to describe, but...
That's okay.
I consider, you know, they're just really pretty Southerns.
Wow.
So they stay smaller. The biggest ones I've ever owned were about 9 feet. You can probably get them up to 12 if you wanted to. Mine never got that big, but I also don't power feed mine and, you know,
right.
try and get them that big. So I'm sure if you wanted to do that, you could, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Gotcha.
A lot of the wild caught Aru's are pretty aggressive, but the captive hatched ones I've gotten are
pretty cool.
Pretty docile.
Okay. So I have to think about that one. Are there any kind of phases or morphs in the different localities and, you know, some of the genetics behind the morphs? Because I don't even know if, you know, you're talking with a complete novice here. I don't even know if scrubs have morphs. So
there are
if they
few.
Are, please inform me.
There are a few. Do you want me to finish with the locality?
Oh, please, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've only started.
Oh, no. I got it.
I'll try and go through them quick.
That's right.
There are also, kind of just going along with the Southerns, the Bayaks, which are also similar to Southerns. That's the one locality I can't, like, actually say, okay, this is how you tell it apart from the other southern localities.
Really?
And mainly that's because I've only seen a few. The only ones we have are from a female that dropped a clutch, a wild-caught female that came in gravid that dropped a clutch of eggs, I think back in the late 90s for VPI. And the only ones I know of that are in the States are from that. And so I've only seen four or five of these, and for the most part, they look like Southerns. And what little variation I've seen are just what kind of looks different than Southerns could just be, you know, something in that clutch, and, you know, who knows if it's actually different than Southerns. And they're interesting because they're on the complete northern side of the island, away from all the other southern localities. And
they're called Southerns.
Yeah. So, and they're more close, they're pretty much genetically identical to them, you know, and not to the Barnecks, which they're actually closer to geographically, which is weird.
Interesting.
Then we have the oxbills are also called Orange Highland, which are one of the, I guess, most prized amethystinas. And they look, to me, a lot like the Arus. But the way to tell them apart is they have, from the side, on their sides, from their pattern down to their belly, they have these orange bars, which are really pretty. And they're the only scrub python that has those. These guys, I've heard they get big, but I've never heard an actual length. I know the ones that were bred in captivity in Europe, they've only been bred twice. Those animals were, I think, under 10 feet, about 7 to 8 feet.
7 to 8.
Awesome. Going to the northern localities, which are the Barnecks. You have you have the Sarong Barnecks, which are from the Sarong or Bird's Head Peninsula, it's also called. They're heavily banded with the dark neck bands. And they also have dark banding on their labials.
Okay.
And their body is completely banded. Well, banded around 2/3 of the way down, and then they have these porthole markings down along their side, which are only on the sarongs. And then the Jayapura Barnecks, have sort of a lighter banding down the back and no porthole markings. And you have Kufis, which are an island form of Barnecks, which are extremely reduced pattern. Like, they barely have, you know, they have the bands down their back, but they tend to be extremely thin compared to the other ones. Then you have the Wilmenas, which I consider kind of a Barnack locality, but they almost have the patterning of a southern. But they do have the dark labials like the other Barnecks, and they have the neck bars. And but what sets them apart is they kind of have a spider web pattern on their neck and black bands on the tail.
Cool.
So, Barnecks get big, up to 16 feet. Wilmenas, biggest one I've had is about 9 feet, but I'm sure you can get them up to 12 if you want.
We'll just keep pushing them, yeah. Wow. That's cool.
That's pretty much it for the
localities.
Amethystines. For the amethystines, at least. So.
Awesome.
And you're asking about the different morphs they have.
Morphs.
There are very few, and most of them haven't been bred at all in captivity.
Oh.
So
they're just funny-looking ones that no one can really figure out. All right.
Exactly.
So what are the kind of morphs that are out there with scrub?
Patternless morph it's fairly common. They're found in northerns and the southerns, the moles, the Moluccans, and the tannin bars. Only in the tannin bars we really know what...
what's going on there?
Yeah. The tannin bars have both a... they both have an exanthic trait and a patternless trait.
Wow.
And both are recessive.
Okay.
And... but the first clutch of patternless animals for southerns was bred recently by a girl named Kim Schoendorf, is her name on the forum. She's over in Europe, and she bred two patternless animals together. And most likely, all the babies will be patternless, you know, whether it's dominant or recessive.
Recessive, right.
And with the southerns, they hatch out patternless anyways and then get the patterning coming in over the next couple sheds.
Oh.
So still too young to see if they are developing a pattern, but I seriously doubt it.
So we won't know until they get bigger.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So and then, I mentioned the Azanthic, it's also found in Moluccans. Luckins, it hasn't been reproduced yet. I think actually Yasser produced one animal from an exanthic, and it seemed normal, and so I think it died soon after it was born or something, but it seemed normal, and from what I've heard with the exanthics is that you can tell it at when they're born, or as a hatchling, if it's going to be that color. They don't really do the whole change, because scrub pythons do hatch out red and then kind of change to their adult coloration. But apparently the exanthics, which the Moluccans, hatch out silver and don't go through the whole ontogenetic color change. So we don't know with the Moluccans, and the Tanabars are interesting because they have these two traits that are very common in their population. They're actually more common. The most common form of the Tanabar is the patternless azantic.
Really?
Which is the double recessive form.
That's the more common of anything, is the double recessive.
Yeah, which is really weird.
Yeah, it's very weird that a double recessive would be the most common thing out there.
And supposedly it's from, it may be from, there's a lot of deforestation going on in the Tanabar Islands. And it may just be, you know, an adaption to blend in with more of an urbanized
interesting
environment.
Kind of like a forced evolution kind of deal.
Yeah.
Cool.
So,
something to think about.
Yeah, it'd be a cool project for somebody to do if anybody ever has a chance.
If anybody's listening who wants to do a project, we just thought of one for you. Go do it now and come back with the results.
All right. Another morph is there's been a few hypos. The main one that we've seen is Yasser Mustafa at Spitfire Reptiles has a hypo male, southern. And he bred it with a striped female. And, you know, as far as I know, he just did it once. And there's both hypos and stripes in the clutch.
And no hypo stripes.
He did have one that was hypo and striped. So
there's always one.
Yeah. So possibly
20, there's only one.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's possibly dominant, but you know, hasn't fully been proven out yet. But
okay.
It probably is, since what would be the chances that the other one was het for it or something as well?
Right. Yeah, that'd be kind of like a 1 in a million shot there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then there's also stripes, as I just kind of mentioned, and that's found in Southerns, Moluccans, and mainly just in those. In the Southerns, it's possibly dominant, as I said, because it was in Yasser's clutch. With the Moluccans, the only info I have on that is when Rolf Kern produced a clutch of Moluccans a few years ago, he did have, I think, two specimens that were produced in the clutch that were striped from normal-looking animals. So, I don't know, it could be possibly recessive. I guess it technically could have been, you know, partially from just incubation.
Right.
But probably not, since it was just the two of them.
Yeah. Interesting.
But again, we don't know for sure until we are able to
pick them apart, right? Now, what morphs are you currently working with, any of those kind of morphs?
I am not.
You're doing the wild type?
Yeah.
Okay.
So right now, I just focus on getting them to breed in the first place, since they're all so hard anyways.
Yeah, baby steps now. Let's get that down, and then we'll figure something else out. Right. No, that's understandable. All right. So as far as it goes with care of for husbandry of scrub. Now, like I said already a few times, I don't have any. So if I wanted to acquire one, where would you suggest I go to get one?
Obviously, probably King Snake's the best place to find them.
Okay.
But there's usually not a whole lot out there. You know, if you're lucky, there might be a couple available for sale, you know, at the time. I think right now there's actually a fair amount of them available. But, yeah, it's probably the best place. And,
okay.
You know, if from known breeders, like David Means usually produces Barnex every year, he'd he'd probably be the best person to get them from right now. There's also Dan, I'm not sure exactly how to say his last name, Mulleary, M-U-L-L-E-A-R-Y. He produced a clutch this year, and I think he got a few adult animals as well from David. So he should hopefully be producing a bunch of Barnex this year.
Okay.
And he's got some for sale right now.
So it's basically like if you were shopping for any other kind of python, it's, you know, King Snake, and then make sure it's from a breeder that you can trust.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There's usually a few wild-caught ones on there. You know, I think there's some wild-caught Southerns on there, and, and maybe I think a few Moluccans right now.
So if you were going to get into scrubs, pretty much wild-caught is something you're going to have to deal with at this point.
Yeah, or just be really patient and wait for somebody to breed what you want. So.
Right. So now you've had wild-caught animals, correct?
Oh, yeah.
All right, now can you give us some tips of trying to get a wild-caught animal to kind of adapt to captivity maybe a little bit better than, you know,
yeah,
kind of put it in a cage. So
yeah.
Make him just deal with it, so...
I mean, the main thing I do is, you know, when I get them in, I have the cage all set up. I throw them in there and just try and leave them alone for, you know, at least a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, give them a hide and, you know, a perch and water and everything you need. And, you know, the only thing I may do with them during that time is I might open up real quick and mist them and close it again and leave. And, you know, then throw in a live mouse or something like that, or, you know, depending on how big it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I usually do that kind of last thing in the night before I leave the snake room for the night. I'll throw in the food, close it, turn out the lights, and go. So a lot of them are very nocturnal, and most of them will take it right away.
Okay.
And, you know, then after that, kind of, I start doing a little more interaction with them and trying to get them to take food off tongs, stuff like that. And after I kind of have them settled in, I may go to my vet and get some, you know, dewormers and stuff. But for the most part, most of them aren't too hard to acclimate.
Okay.
So they like to eat. I mean, they pretty much will eat anything you throw at them. So it's not too hard. I think a big part of it, though, is just kind of letting them settle in, get accustomed to their surroundings, and just, you know, acclimate. I think that's a huge part of it.
Right. And I've heard of at the zoo, we used to get in a few. I got wild-caught cane toads in, and we, you know, the directors of the zoo made us panic cure them like instantly the second they got in the door, and that kind of really stressed them out and let them kind of, it was kind of a really kind of a fight to get them to feed and settle in. So what you're saying is just kind of let them settle first, and then if you got to, go and mess with them with the dewormers and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, I don't worry too much about worms, especially at first. You know, it's it's not going to kill the thing right away. You know, you know, but stress will, you know.
Right, yeah.
So
you freak it out, it'll just die, so I got
you. I mean, let it settle in, let it rehydrate, and, you know, just relax a bit and, you know, become comfortable. And then, you know, after that, they should do great. You know, don't
awesome.
Don't take it out and try and play with it. Show it off to your friends or whatever. You know, just leave it alone.
don't show it off to everybody in the block. Just leave it be. Okay. That seems like sound advice that you shouldn't have to give, but yeah, probably should anyway. Now, can you give us some general reviews of the care for these guys? Like, what are the temps that you keep them at? What kind of cages do you use, and what do you feed them?
Yeah, with pretty much all of mine, I keep them at about 82 degrees, and with the exception of the Halmaheras, I don't actually give them a hot spot at all.
Okay.
I don't think they necessarily need it, and I think they actually do better without it, mainly for reasons for reproduction. I think if you have them too hot, they kind of will develop the follicles too fast and won't ovulate right and kind of produce bad eggs. And that actually goes with a lot of pythons. But in Halmaheras, they actually need warmer temperatures, so I actually give them a hot spot in the mid to upper 80s. Otherwise,
okay.
they tend to stop eating.
Mm-hmm.
So that get warm, and they like it really humid. So let's see, caging, you know, I start out the babies with in bins. They
right.
require a lot of humidity, and it's, you know, with such long arboreal tails, it's really easy for them to get a stuck shed, and then, you know, it cuts off circulation of the tail, and you can, you know, lose a section of the tail, and, which is not good.
No.
And, you know, just kind of get bigger bins as they get older, and then once they get, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet or so, or even 4 feet, I give them, you know, most of my adults are in 2x2x2 vision cages with
okay.
perches and all that. And then my biggest ones, which are like my Barnecks and my Wominas, are in 4x2x2 cages. I don't have any that are really over 10 feet or anything, so that's as big as I need right now.
Right. Do you give them a night drop or anything like that, or during breeding season?
During breeding season, I will drop it down to low 70s.
Low 70s, okay.
Yeah.
As far as you need to go down for them?
Yeah, they, you know, they're all from pretty tropical, you know, places, sort of near the equator. So they're not.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a huge difference in seasonal temperatures or anything.
Right.
I don't know if that makes such sense, but...
No, it does. no, you're good.
Put
it
makes
most
it. Eloquently, but...
it's fine. Everyone understands. So.
All right. As long as everybody got my point, I guess that's what's important.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, they don't necessarily need, you know, anything into the 60s or anything. With some of them, you probably are able to, you know, drop them down into the upper 60s if you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with ones like the Waminas and Oxibills that are supposedly from higher elevations, they might, you know, kind of like the lower temperatures like that.
Yeah.
But I'm still working on breeding the Waminas, and only two people bred the Oxibills. Now, as far as I know, they didn't take them down anything like that, but it might help.
Well, who knows? So what do you feed your scrubs?
I mean, they will eat anything you give them. They are not picky at all. They're not like, you know, Irian Jaya's or anything that will only want mice and be reluctant to eat rats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you put something in there, they will probably eat it. But I mainly just feed mine, you know, mice when they're young and rats when they're older. I don't really let mine get big enough where they'll need rabbits or anything like that. They'll take them for sure, but I think for the most part, their scrubs are best kept about 7-8 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all of them will breed at that size, and I think it's healthier for them. You know, I don't think it's good for you to push them to the extremes of their you know, of their size. You know what I mean? And, you know, also, you know, it's best to keep them lean. Scrub pythons are, you know, they're really hard. They're harder to breed than the most other species of python. And I think a big part of that is obesity. And if they're too obese, then the females won't have enough room to fully develop the follicles. And, you know, they may start to ovulate, and then just the fat will keep it from fully developing.
Right. So, now for misting, you do mist the scrubs. I know you said that they enjoy humidity. And,
yeah.
And how often do you mist them? You mist them every day?
Usually not every day. Usually at least a couple times a week. Because, I mean, they really like it, and especially like the Moluccans, Halmaharas, and the Tanimbars. I mean, they'll pretty much drink every time you spray them.
And they drink it off their scales, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, a lot of Halmaharas, you know, at least when you first get them in, like the wild-caught ones and stuff, don't seem to know what a water bowl is. So the only way you can get them to drink is to mist them. And you kind of got to
figure out the water bowl.
Yeah, exactly. And but you got to find a, you know, right medium between misting them enough to keep them alive or keep them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, keeping them soaked where they will develop, you know, belly rot and blisters and all that. So, which is why I, you know, only miss mine, you know, a couple times a week.
Okay.
You know, whereas if you do it every day, you might risk, you know, them being damp forever. But, I mean, if you do that, just kind of keep an eye on the substrate. If the substrate is always soaked, or if you, you know, move the substrate aside and that, you know, the bottom layer's wet, you might want to back off on your misting.
Yeah.
And, you know, misting's especially important when they're in shed, obviously.
Right.
They do require higher humidity than, like, carpet pythons. My amethystines, probably, I usually keep about 60 to 70% humidity.
Okay.
And, Halmaharas, Moluccans, and Tanimbars, probably a little higher, 70, 80%.
Now, I've seen, like, some kind of arboreal cages where they have complete water bottoms that have heating underneath it, and that kind of gets the water cooking and humidity going. Would that be kind of overkill a little bit for these guys?
Yeah, I think so. But,
okay.
I mean, if you want to do that, I mean, I'm sure that's fine. In some, you know, in some places where maybe if you have, you know, live in like Arizona or something where it's extremely dry and you're having trouble, you know, keeping the humidity for it, that might be something good to try.
Right.
But, like for my setup, I don't think I need anything like that.
Okay.
So
now, were there any other kind of special requirements that you should really kind of, little tidbits and tricks we should try to do? Like, do they need to be covered sometimes? So, you know, is there anything else, little special tips to kind of get them happy and acclimated?
Keep them happy and acclimated. They're semi-arboreal. They love perches. I highly recommend, you know, always giving them a perch and, you know, a hide box. And they will use both. Other than that, there's not too much else. A few things
right.
I could recommend for the keeper for their sake, you know. I always keep whenever I deal with any of my scrubs, I usually have a second hook standing by. You know, I always hook out all of mine just because typically when you open the cage, they come flying out.
Don't reach in the cage. All right.
I mean, some of them you can, but, just kind of on the safe side, I always use a hook to get mine out, and then, you know, with my calm ones, I will, you know, just grab them with my hand once they're out and once they realize they're not being fed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with aggressive ones, sometimes they'll wrap around the hook that you have and
take it with them.
Yeah, and so they'll be sitting there wrapped around your hook trying to bite you, and you'll want another hook to kind of get them off of that and maneuver them wherever you want. And
got it. So always have spare hooks. I got it.
Exactly. I can't recommend that more.
Yeah. I'm feeling you learned this the hard way. So.
Oh, yeah. And there's been times where, you know, I open a bin or something, it comes flying out, and I have one hook, and it grabs or whatever, and the other hook is on the other side of the bin.
I've done that so many times.
Like,
oh. Like, open the cage, and the carpet's pissed for that one day, and I'm like, where's my hook? Oh, over there. So, yeah. You should have, like, tethers attached to them so you can pull them over. But anyway, now, do you have any tips for taming a scrub? Like, you know, trying to get it acclimated to be handleable or playing with it or, you know.
I mean, not any more than with your usual snake, but.
Right.
I mean, if you are wanting to tame scrub, you are, you know, if you are worried about having an aggressive one, then definitely buy a captive bred baby.
Okay.
And then, you know, after you got it acclimated in and everything and it's eating great, then start handling it, you know, maybe with a pair of gloves, something like that, until it gets used to you handling it. And most of them do calm down fairly quickly. You know, they're a lot like carpet pythons in that regards, where they will be really nippy as babies and kind of grow out of it. And, I mean, I don't think they're as bad as the reputation puts them out.
Right.
Most of their aggression is just an extreme feeding response.
Huh.
And, you know, you'll open the bin and or cage or whatever, and they just come flying out because they think they're being fed. And, you know, a lot of them, especially adults, once you get them out of that feeding response, they're actually pretty calm.
Hmm.
So,
awesome.
I mean, I've noticed with a lot of them, they, you know, you open the cage, they are flying out and everything, and you get them out, or you kind of start coaxing them out with the hook, and then they kind of go into a lot of them will go into a flight mode where they just try and get away. And at that point, you know, almost always, you know, I can just grab them with my bare hand, and they just continue trying to get away. They don't try and bite at all. And,
okay. Tell them glide through your hands kind of
deal.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
all right, I guess I'll have to try handling one at some point.
They really are fun. I really enjoy them. They're my favorite snake. You know, I always seem to want more of them for some reason. So.
Well, you know, the question we always ask everybody is if you could pick one species of Morelia you could get in your collection, what would it be? So,
if I could get one that,
no, it's tough.
It is tough. You know, I certainly would love Australian scrubs in my collection. The more I look at them, the more, you know, I realize how pretty they are. You know, as I was kind of talking about at the beginning, they look a lot like Southerns to me, but
right.
You know, the more I look at them, they, you know, I find that really are different, and they kind of have, you know, they can. I've seen some that seem to have more of an orangish color and more of a gold, and really are more beautiful snakes than I gave them credit for at first, and would love a pair of those. What else? You know, there's also some scrubs from the Bismarcks that I mentioned before, and
yeah,
I've only seen one picture of them, but, you know, I would love to be able to get some of those in and see what they're like and try and breed them and all that. And
cool. Well, I know it's insanely difficult to breed these guys, so hopefully it's, I know it's a lot harder than, you know, my spotted pythons and my carpet pythons.
Yeah.
So, you have all the better stuff. Eric did send me one thing. He wanted to know for the Moluccans, the Tenenbaums and the Helmut Harris, their natural history, if you know them, what their natural environment is, and their average sizes. And I think he also said the morphs, but I think we covered that earlier. So,
yeah.
So what are the natural history for those three guys?
Well, unfortunately, we know very little about them in the wild. You know, I've looked up a little bit on the islands themselves. Let's start with Tenenbaums, I guess. So they, as I said earlier, they're the smallest ones. They average about 6 feet or so. They kind of fill the niche of green tree pythons in the islands where they're from. They're a little more arboreal than other scrub pythons. They will spend a lot of time in the trees. And as I said before, there are four phases of each. You know, there's the azanthic, xanthic, patternless, and patterned. Usually when they're born, you know, they're all red. You can tell the pattern. You can tell if it's patterned or patternless. But you usually can't tell their color until about a year old. I know one of the things with the islands there, they're rampant deforestation, which is a major problem for them. And as I said, that's most likely the reason why, could be the reason why they have they kind of seem to be going towards this, you know, more towards the azanthic coloration than the gold coloration, which is their normal color.
Normal. Gotcha.
So, and actually, I part of my goal with my personal collection is to breed more of the gold ones and get more of those out there because you almost don't
see
them anymore.
Yeah, they're becoming the rare ones.
Yeah. So, and I actually like those more. Mostly that island is just rainforest. That's one of the reasons, or that's why I think all three of those are from very rainforesty. Is that even a word? Very tropical, rainforest, and that's pretty much where all those islands are. And that's why they require a little bit more humidity than the other ones, than like the Amethystinas. I keep them a little more humid because they will have bad sheds a lot easier than the Amethystinas.
Okay.
What else can I say about them? They've been bred a few times here in the U.S. Not incredibly often. There may be, you know, one clutch of them produced every year. And then we get probably another clutch or two from Indonesia every year.
Okay.
So they're hard to breed, but they are kind of one of the more readily bred ones, you know, which is kind of sad because they're really not that bred that often. So, you know, I used to think, you know, they were one of the hardest, but then I realized, well, they're bred a lot more than, Moluccans or Halma Harris. So actually bred fairly often for the group. Moluccans, tropical rainforest, they get, you know, up to about 12 feet, but, 8 to 10 seems to be more of the average.
Okay.
They're kind of a bright gold. Their patterning is similar a little bit to Southerns and Arus, but their gold is more of a yellowish gold, whereas like Arus are more, I guess I would just get more of a brownish gold, if that makes sense.
It does, to me at least.
Good. So, and, I'd argue that the Moluccans are possibly the prettiest scrub pythons, in my opinion. But maybe that's just because I like gold snakes or yellow, bright yellow snakes.
Who doesn't, so it's okay.
And, they have the exanthic form, which I mentioned earlier, we don't know. It's bright silver. Not necessarily bright silver. Some of them are kind of dull, but cool-looking silver morph with black eyes and really pretty. Awesome. Those have been bred only a handful of times, you know, maybe four. A couple years ago, Anthony Caponetto and Rolf Kern both produced a clutch of these guys. And then a year or two ago, another guy produced a small clutch of them. And several years ago, Yasser produced a clutch. I think one hatched, and I think it died shortly after hatching.
Huh.
So there's been pretty much four clutches that I know of in the U.S. they come in fairly regularly, and occasionally we get females that are gravid while coming in. David Means has a group of ones that came in from a wild caught gravid female, and I think she laid five eggs, and which is considered a small clutch, but I mean, that kind of goes with my thought of that they breed a lot smaller than we think they breed.
Okay.
You know, they lay pretty much, well, at least the Moluccans, they seem to lay carpet-size eggs. You know, some of the Barnecks and those, they lay much bigger eggs, but, you know, I got some captive hatched ones that were before their first shed, and they are pretty much the size of a hatchling carpet.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the keys to breeding a lot of these guys is just trying to not get them so big and try and breed them at a smaller size. What else about those guys? So I guess I'll move on to the Halmaheras. From what I read about the Halmahera Islands is that it's actually not very densely populated. There's it's mainly rainforest, and I think I read that over 90% of their forests are still intact.
Really?
Which is really good, and that's
pretty,
not something to
nice,
hear
actually.
Every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So probably their populations are doing really, really well. These guys are the only scrub pythons with red irises, which kind of give them a cool, like, kind of evil look.
That's awesome, actually. Very cool.
They tend to be more of a brown to, I don't know, some can almost kind of have a greenish coloration, not like a chondro. Not quite that green, but I don't know, I guess kind of an olive green. And they actually seem fairly, what's it called, variable. And they have the broadest bands along their back out of any scrub python. Way more broader than Barnecks or anything, which is kind of the other way to tell them apart.
Okay.
And those are, right now, the only python species in captivity that has yet to be bred.
Wow.
And which, that's one of my main projects I'm trying to work on, is I'm trying to breed them. Hoping I have some success this year from them. And we know practically nothing about them in the wild, unfortunately.
Wow.
One report we have of what they feed on is fruit bats. But
good luck trying to reproduce those in, you know, captivity. Getting fruit bats for your feeders is a little
exactly
hard. Yeah.
So there's been some speculation that they need fruit bats or something like that to survive, because they are probably the hardest one to keep alive. I've been doing pretty good with mine. I've had mine for several years now. I think a big part of that is, you know, just keeping them warmer and keeping them humid and spraying them often. And they seem to be doing pretty well. And we've even seen breeding behavior in mind, which I almost don't even want to say out loud because I don't want to jinx myself.
I don't even want to say it.
But, you know, I heard one report from somebody that said he saw, you know, some of the first babies that came into the country of the Halmaheras, and he said that they do not start out red.
Really?
And I don't know, you know, I can't say if that's true or not. That would be really interesting if it is. You know,
mm-hmm.
It could possibly be, you know, that the animal is a little bit bigger than they, or a little bit older than they thought it was. Who knows? I mean, we won't be able to tell for sure until somebody hatches them out. I find that pretty interesting.
That's very cool.
So, because that'd be the only species in that group that doesn't start out red. So.
Yeah. Now, speaking of red babies, I know the Baleen's pythons, they technically fit under the scrub category, correct?
Yeah, they're kind of a sister species to that.
Okay.
And I've worked with scrub pythons here at the zoo, and to me, they kind of seemed like, I don't know if it's just me or not, but they kind of seemed like their tails weren't quite as long compared to their body as scrubs.
Okay.
They almost seemed a little shorter. To me, their heads look a little bit more blunt, and they seem a little more heavily bodied. We got some hatchlings here a couple of years ago that I raised that I was amazed at their size. They're a lot bigger. They seemed a lot bigger than most of the scrub hatchlings I've seen. So
wow, that's something cool to compare them to the baleens to the scrubs.
Yeah, so,
interesting.
I like those a lot. I really would love to get some of those in my collection.
Hmm.
So,
well, those would be the ones you want to add too. So
exactly
on the list. Everybody has a list. It's okay. So for breeding, like I said, I know it's very difficult. I mean, I throw my males in with my females, and then when the female produces eggs, I'm a happy carpet python breeder. I know you probably have to do a lot more with the touch and go and the cycling and stuff like that. Can you give us a rundown of the temps, cycling, what you do for intros, things like that, for a few of the species of scrubs, if they're different than everybody else's?
I mean, for the most part, I do the same with all of them, where I'm basically what I'm trying this year is more of a food cycling on top of temperature drop. So, because, you know, I was thinking about it for a while and talking with other keepers that kind of, I mean, got this thought in my head, and I was thinking about that, you know, animals in the wild, they will want to breed when food is plenty, you know.
Right.
When things are good out, you want to breed, you know, that's a good time to breed and bring more snakes or whatever into the wild. So started dropping my temperatures and start, you know, feeding them real well. And especially if, you know, one of them, I like to introduce them after one of them sheds. Going to feed them, shed, throw them together and see what happens. And then if they're sitting apart from each other, I just take them apart for a few days, throw them back together. And I'm only a couple weeks into my breeding season this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's kind of my plan. I'm going to keep feeding them until they decide to go off feed themselves. And but I'm feeding them smaller meals. I'm not feeding them like jumbo rats or anything like that. You know, I'm feeding them plenty of meals that are, you know, just giving them a slight bulge, you know, because I don't want them to, I'm kind of, I don't know, paranoid about getting them fat. But one of my pet peeves is, you know, fat snakes.
Right.
So, you know, I'm pretty paranoid about it. And so, you know, I kind of try and keep a fine line between too skinny and too fat.
Okay.
So, you know, I feed them a lot of small meals and throw them together, and I'm seeing some good signs already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've also kind of upped the humidity on mine, where I'm, you know, some of them I am almost misting a little bit every day. Seeing if that helps. I mean, we know so little about when they actually breed on a lot of these.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially like the Moluccans and Halmaheras. So, you know, I'm just kind of playing around with stuff. And, you know, you take a few weeks to bring it down to lower 70s and then keep that there for about 8 weeks or so and then slowly bring it back up. And, I mean, that's basically it for now. Oh, but I would like to touch on, you know, it's been said a lot that there is, you know, that the males will fight. You can't throw males together. And with some of the species, I found that I haven't found them to do that at all.
They don't, like, there's no combating or anything like that? They'll just chill
with
out?
The Moluccans, the Tanimbars, and the Halmaheras, I mean, I originally would start throwing a male in with the other one to see if I can get, you know, them, like with carpets.
Because
I do that a lot with my carpets, and I'll throw them in with each other for a few minutes, let them kind of get pissed off and tang apart, and I throw them in there, and they didn't really do anything. You know?
They just shared the space.
You know, and they just seemed okay with the other ones being in there, and so it's kind of like, all right. So, you know, I kind of sat there for a while, and, you know, hour or so goes by, and I'm sitting there, and they're, you know, they're cruising around checking each other out and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, that, you know, males might spur the female, you know, get that stuff
right.
going on. And I was like, well, nothing's happening. Maybe I'll leave them together for a little while longer. And, you know, so I'd go watch some TV, check back, you know, every couple of minutes or whatever, and, you know, now I've gotten to the point where, you know, I can leave, you know, with any of those three species, I can leave males together for extended periods of time and, you know, with a female and, you know, no fighting or anything.
Huh.
I just recently tried it for the first time with amethystines, the male Barnack and a male Wamina.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't see much of combat, but they are, the males were kind of small. So
mm-hmm.
I know, talking with David, he said he's put Barnacks together and they would fight.
Okay.
I know it is recorded in the King Horneye. So, I mean, it's something I like to play around with and, you know, just, you know, I've asked people before, you know, with Tanimbars or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, use, you know, when people have bred them before, a lot of times when somebody breeds a scrub python, I usually email them and just ask them, you know, what they did and everything, just find out new information.
Right.
I've emailed people before and saying, oh, I don't know why at the time it occurred to me to ask them because this person had used multiple males. I'd ask, you know, well, did you ever put them in together? No, they'd kill each other, you know.
Oh.
And, I just decided to try it out later, and they didn't do anything. So I think some of it, you know, it's, you know, one species in the group does it, and, it, you know, people hear that, and they just, you know, think it goes for them all. And I think, you know, each one might be different, and, you know, a different case for each one. You know, I don't know if that's making a lot of sense.
It makes sense. I just imagine you all geared up, ready for a huge fight, and then nothing happens.
Yeah.
So
but it does seem to stimulate some sort of, you know, breeding behavior. Like with the Tanimbars, you know, you put them together, and one of the males would go and sit on the female and kind of be like, "This is mine," you know, and they won't fight, but it'll stimulate them.
You'll make sure
you know, yeah. So and you know if. Though, you know, here's my kind of disclaimer, you know, if you're going to try this, you know, with any of the species, you know, don't throw in two Luckins together or whatever, you know, two males with a female, and go, Blake told me they'd be fine and leave for the weekend. You know, cause
I was told it'd be okay.
You know, always watch them, you know, when you're first introducing them and everything. And, you know, I, even when I do it now, I will kind of sit there for a little bit and just make sure.
Right.
You never know.
It's like when I try to breed my Cal Kings, you know, are you going to eat each other?
Yeah.
No? Okay. So, yeah, it's fine. They don't need a light cycle or anything like that. You don't have to play with their lights too much, do you?
No, I mean, they're all pretty close to the equator, so there's not really much of a
doesn't really much matter too much.
So.
Okay. As far as their eggs set up, do you do maternal, or do you set them up in an incubator? And if you do set them up in the incubator, how do you set them up in the incubator?
Well, I have yet to actually produce any myself.
Okay.
But I probably would set them up in an incubator, at least at first, or at least for my first ones, because I don't know. I don't trust maternal incubation yet.
Yeah, neither do I.
I would really like to try it. You know, I've tried it a few times, and each time the females left the eggs, and it just didn't turn out like I would want them to. And I'm not going to – I want to keep trying and get – be able to do that, but I'm not going to try it with my scrub pythons at first, you know. So,
right.
I'll try it with something else where, you know, I won't be so pissed at myself for losing the clutch that, you know, that I'll, you know, want to kill myself or something.
Yeah.
You know, if I got the first clutch of Halmahera python eggs.
And mom killed them all, yeah.
Man, I'd be so pissed. So,
yeah, I understand that.
But, I mean, the eggs are pretty much just like any other python species. The only difference is they actually incubate a lot longer. They're closer to 90 days rather than 60.
Okay.
And really, after you get eggs, hatching the eggs is the easy part. It's just getting good eggs is the hard part with scrub pythons.
Okay.
I remember Ryan Young told me that years ago when he got tanumbar python eggs, and I think he was like the third person in the U.S. to breed them. He's making a trip down to Texas when they were supposed to hatch.
Oh,
and
God.
So he set them up in a little incubator that he was able to plug into his car, and they hatched on the road. He's like, I'm not going to miss that.
I really hope that they were sound, otherwise, you know, they'd be loose all over the car.
Yeah.
God.
So I left with eggs and came back with babies.
And now, in your experience, hatchlings, do they take quick to food? Are they okay with that stuff? Are they kind of a bitch to get going?
They're pretty easy.
Okay.
With all the ones I've started, I've gotten several that, you know, straight out of the egg practically, and after the first shed, they'll pretty much take whatever you put in there.
Nice.
I usually start off with, you know, fuzzy or hopper mice.
Just kind of let them go from there?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Now, what projects are you currently working on this coming season? Like, what are you kind of hoping to get?
I'm trying my Wominas, which those have yet to be bred in captivity. Trying a pair of Barnecks and Tanumbars. I've got my gold patternless female or xanthic patternless female that mainly trying to breed her with my patterned xanthic male because with that pairing I could potentially get all four color phases.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm really hoping for a patterned xanthic, which there haven't been too many of those produced, even though that's the, you know, supposed to be the wild type.
Yeah.
But then I've also been putting her with two of my patternless xanthic males. You know, I'll put her in with the patterned male and you know, when they're kind of lose interest, I throw in with one of the other males and then back with him and just kind of swap them back and forth. But she's been breeding with the pattern male so far.
Excellent.
And then
so you should be kind of knee deep in scrub babies if everything goes well.
I hope so. I'm seeing. I almost don't want to talk too much, you know, about it because I'm a little paranoid.
They might hear
but,
you, yeah.
But I'm hoping so. I'm seeing some good signs. You know, it's still early, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm also trying Halmaharas, which, you know, I'm not holding my breath for.
Okay.
Female's small still. I think she could lay a small clutch. Just based on what I know of them. Yeah, I'm not holding my breath, and I'm not expecting anything.
Right.
My Waminas, the pair I'm trying, I put them together right after both of them shed. I kind of lucked out that they both went in to shed the same time and shed it within days of each other, so I threw them together, and they pretty much spend all their time curled up in a big ball in their hide box.
Nice.
So I'm hoping something's going on there, and, you know, most likely something is. Whether I get anything is another story, but...
Hopefully.
And I think I've seen some action with my Barnecks. Got those from David Means a little while ago, and... you know, my male is pretty small still. He's
okay.
Maybe 6 feet at most, which males can breed pretty small. And, you know, I just kind of figured, well, I'll try him anyways.
Give him a shot.
Yeah. Female seems to be big enough, so we'll see what happens.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Hopefully everything turns out and you are knee-deep in scrub babies, like I said. So, anyway, that was all the questions I have for you today, Blake. If people want to get in contact with you, how would they go ahead on that?
You can check out my website, pythoncentral.com. You can email me, pythoncentral@gmail.com. And also a couple weeks ago, I started a Facebook page for my business. I just figured it'd be a good other way to get my name out there. And I also
Facebook helps. Yeah.
Yeah. I figured it couldn't hurt.
Yeah.
So.
I started one for my company and people keep liking it. And like, you know, I'm finding more reptile friends, breeders and stuff are liking it. And that leads me to more reptile people. So it's
yeah.
fine.
And I find I do little updates on that more often than I do my, real website. And
yeah.
I figured it's also easier for people to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
So just look up Python Central page. You can just like it or whatever. And
yeah.
It's pretty easy.
Whatever that is. Also, they can find you on the Morelia's forums as well, right?
Yep, I'm on there pretty often. I don't always post, but I usually check it several times a day. So.
Well, everyone does. So, all right. Well, all right, Blake. Thank you very much for coming on with me. Eric probably wishes he could be here. Again, it was awesome chatting with you, and I definitely learned a lot about scrubs already, and if you end up breeding this year, I may give you a call to pick up my one, okay?
All right, sounds good. Thanks for having me on, and I hope Eric feels better.
I hope so, too, but I'm kind of going mad with power over here, so it's okay. So
I'm gonna have to give him a really hard time about, you know.
Please.
He's been so excited for this, and we set this up months ago, and... Where is he? I mean, I know he's sitting there behind his keyboard or whatever listening in, but, you know.
He's listening mad as hell. So, I definitely suggest giving him a hard time. I believe maybe a thread on the forums is in order, but I don't know. I'll leave that up to you and the general public. This way I can wash my hands of it and not be in trouble later. So,
all right.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Blake.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
All right, you have a good night, okay?
All right, you too. Later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so in the next couple weeks, what we have going on here for all you Morelia Minutes heads, whatever. Yeah, all right, so for the next week on 12-3, we have David Means for the second edition of the Scrub Talk, and I hope Eric is feeling better for that time. Also on 12-10, we have Chris from Headhunter Reptiles. That would be the best place. That's one of the best places you can get jungle carpets is at Headhunter. Then on 12-17, I am personally excited about this one. We have Mr. Michael Pennell on. Michael Pennell breeds excellent coastal carpet pythons. I have several of his girls and boys, and I actually have one very good-looking girl that I'm crossing with my caramel male this year. After Michael Pennell, we're going to take 2 weeks off for Christmas break. This way Eric and I can do all that fun stuff. Again, I want to thank Mr. Blake for coming on, Blake Bauer from Python Central. His website, again, is pythoncentral.com. As always, you can reach almost everybody who's on the show, as well as myself and Eric, on MoreliaPythons.com. It is the best forum out there and the best place to get all your information on carpet pythons. Also, as a reminder, we do have the Morelia Python calendar that is coming out soon. I believe the polls are up now. You can vote on which pictures you want to be included in which month, all that other fun stuff. And definitely get a calendar. You can hang it in your snake room. You can write down the dates of Morelia Python Minutes, as well as, you know, who we're having on the show and upcoming snake shows. Also, any questions, suggestions for guests, or any other things you need to contact with me or Eric can be done through MoreliaPythonRadio@gmail.com. Myself, I will be at the Hamburg Reptile Show on December 3rd, and I'm pretty sure I might be able to convince Eric to come out and hang out at the table so you can come chat with us. It's always cool to see people at the shows. My website is rogue-reptiles.com, and you can reach me there. Anyway, I think that's all we got for the show today. Tune in next time, and I wish everybody out there a good night. And if anybody does see Eric or message him or call him, please tell him to get well soon, and we miss him greatly. All right? Everybody have a good night out there.